in 1 month's time. Then, I will come and I will take over your body and you shall be allowed to go to an astral world so that you may recover your tranquility and know that there is joy in living. Then I said, it would help us greatly, greatly, if you would tell us your life story, because although we have seen much in the astral by way of the Akashic records, there still is a boon to be derived by hearing the actual experiences from the person concerned. He looked dreadfully truculent again, and said, no, no, I cannot bear to speak of it, I am not going to say another word. Sadly, we turned away and went into the astral world so that we could again consult the Akashic record to see much of his life. But in the Akashic record one sees all that has happened, one does not necessarily get the unspoken opinions of a person, we see the act but not the thought which preceded the act. But let us now take a leap forward from those days many years ago. The young man now, many, many years in the astral world, has mellowed somewhat and to some small extent appreciates the difficulties with which we are confronted. He has, then, agreed to tell us his own life story. Here upon the astral world, and I, Lobsang Rampa, here upon the world of earth, trying to write down precisely as dictated those things which the young man tells. We will have his story shortly, but it is necessary to emphasize that names will not be given, for they cause distress to others. This is not a story of vengeance, this is not a story of bitterness. Actually, it is a story in this book of triumph over seemingly impossible obstacles. There have been many attempts to stop my books, but I have ever been mindful of the way a man steps forth, even though dogs be yapping at his feet. I have ever been mindful that a man can continue his work even though midges and blowflies swarm about him. So I say, I have no need for bitterness, for that which I wanted to do is now possible, and my present task is just to complete the task of another who fell by the roadside. Again, I say with the utmost sincerity at my command that all these books of mine are true, utterly true. They are written without author's license, they contain the truth as these things happen to me. All the things that I write about I can do, but not for public exhibition, because I am neither charlatan nor showman. The things I do are for the completion of my task. So now let us turn the page and read what there is that the young man said. Chapter 8. This is the story of the life of the host. It is a story which is difficult in the telling, because the teller is on the astral plane and the one who has to transcribe it is upon the earth plane in the city of Calgary, Alberta, Canada. This life story is out of context. It interposes a break between that which has already been written and the part which naturally would continue, but when one is dealing with affairs of the astral, then one has to make some concessions in the matter of time, because time on the astral plane is not the same as time on the earth plane. Hence this life story is being given now, and the explanation as to why it is being now is made here to avoid a spate of letters asking all manner of questions. From this point on, then to and until I so indicate, everything written is dictated by the one whom we will call the host. Grandfather was a very important man indeed, at least in the rural district of Plympton, which, so far as I remember, included Plympton St. Mary, Plympton St. Maurice, Underwood and Colebrook, together with quite a number of other sub-locations. Grandfather was chief of the waterworks of Plympton. Every day he used to go in pony and trap all the way up the hill, until a mile or so uphill he came to an enclosed mound with a little hut on it. The reservoir was covered in. Grandfather used to go up there with a 4-foot stick, one end of which was saucer-shaped and the other rounded. He used to walk about with his ear to the saucer-shaped end, the other end he put in contact with the ground, and he could hear the water rushing through the pipes below to feed the taps of Plympton, Underwood, Colebrook, and other districts. Grandfather also had quite a thriving business, employing several men and a lot of apprentices. He taught them plumbing, hence the scurrilous tales which later were to arise, tinsmithing, and general engineering. In those days, right at the start of the century, people did not rush to supermarkets to obtain kettles, saucepans, frying pans, and all the rest of it. These things were made by hand, and grandfather's men made them. grandfather lived at Mayoralty House in Plympton St. Maurice, the house really had been the house of the men. It was right opposite the Guildhall and the police station. Mayoralty House consisted of 4 to 5 acres of land divided into 3 sections. The first section abutted from the 4-story house and formed a walled garden of probably just under an acre. In that garden near the house there was a grotto built of very large pebbles and with windows of various colored glasses. Outside that there was a small lawn with flowers and plants all along the edges. In the middle there was a large fish pond nicely tiled and with a fountain and with water wheels at the ends. A jet of water could be turned on and the water wheels would spin around. Then there was a little bob which went down into the water, and at certain times of the day fish would pull on that bob and a bell would ring and then they would be fed. Facing the fish pond there were 2 large wall aviaries, very carefully maintained and thoroughly cleaned. In these there were 2 dead trees fixed against the wall and it provided an ideal spot for the very tame birds. The birds were so tame that when grandfather went into the aviaries, by opening the doors of course, none of the birds flew out. Further down to that first part of the garden there was a greenhouse, one of grandfather's joys. And beyond that a small orchard. Outside that walled garden there was a private roadway which left the main street and went down under part of Mayoralty House which went as a bridge across that roadway and at the bottom there were what had been malt houses in days gone by. The malt houses were not used when I knew them because it was much cheaper, apparently, to ship malt into Plympton from a few hundred miles away. By the malt house there was the fire station. Grandfather owned the fire brigade and he had horses which drew the fire engines to the scene of the fire. He did all this as a public service, but if businesses or big households were saved from burning down then grandfather, of course, charged them a reasonable fee. But for poor people he made no charge. The fire engines were very well maintained and they were manned by volunteers or by his own staff. Here, too, there were the yards where much of his outdoor equipment was kept, wagons and things like that. Here, too, he had 2 peacocks which were his pride and joy and which always came to him when he made certain noises. One went through that yard and through a gate into a garden which was, I suppose, about 2.5 or 3 acres in extent. Here he grew vegetables, fruit trees, and the whole garden was extremely well cared for. Beneath the house, beneath that 4-story house, there were workshops without any windows but seemingly well ventilated. Here master craftsmen, tinsmiths, coppersmiths, and apprentices worked, and they had to work quite hard too. Grandfather had 2 sons as well as a daughter. Both sons were thrust willy-nilly into apprenticeship. They had to learn general engineering, tinsmithing, coppersmithing and the ubiquitous plumbing, and they had to stay at their studies until they could pass all the tests and get a certificate of registration. My father was quite a good engineer but after a time he broke away from grandfather saying that grandfather's control was too strict, too domineering. My father went away to a different house still in St. Maurice but it was called Brick House because it was the only red brick house in that street. Father married and for a time lived in St. Maurice. First a son was born who shortly died, and then a daughter was born, and quite a time after I was born, and I have always believed that I was the unwanted accident. Certainly I was never favored in any way, I was never popular, never permitted to have friends. Everything I did was automatically wrong, everything my sister did was automatically right. It makes one rather disgruntled after a time to always be the unwanted one and to see the favorite get everything, to see her with her friends and her parties and all the rest of it. Even second best was considered to be too good for me. Mother and father moved to Ridgeway in the parish of St. Mary. There they started a business, no, not plumbing, an engineering business which included electricity, which was only then coming into popular use. My father was a very nice man indeed so far as he could afford to be a very nice man. He was a Scorpio, and my mother was a Virgo. She had come from an extremely good family in another part of Devonshire. The family had had a lot of money previously and a lot of land, but her father and a neighbor fell to quarreling over a right of way, and well eventually they went to law. A verdict was given and was appealed, and so it went on until they had hardly any money left. Certainly they had no money to continue litigation, and so the land which had been the cause of all the trouble was sold. Mother and father did not get on. Mother was too domineering. She was known locally as the lady because of her high ambitions. She had been made very bitter by the loss of the family fortunes. Unfortunately, she seemed to take her bitterness out on her husband and on me. Grandfather had a brother who was a most talented artist. He was a Royal Academician and had made a very satisfactory name for himself. I remember one painting of his in particular always enthralled me. It was a picture of the old Barbican, Plymouth, the Barbican as it was when the Mayflower sailed for the USA. This was a wonderful picture. It glowed with living color, it was mellow, and one could look at it and actually soon find that one was there. Uncle Richard, as we called him, always said that the picture would go to one of us children. It did. To my sister, and it is one thing which I really, really coveted. It was the thing that I wanted above all else, except a few years later when I had been promised a model train, a blue train, and to my juvenile eyes it was the most wonderful train in the whole world. I had been solemnly promised it, and then on the day I was to have it I was told, "Oh no, you can't have it. Your sister wants a piano. Your father and I are going to get it now." Yes, I really wanted that train as I wanted the picture. Things like that were always happening. My sister had a wonderful bicycle, I was left to walk. But that is not the purpose of this writing. I am having to tell all this because, I am told, it was part of the agreement when I consented to have my body taken over. I was sick of the damned body anyhow. It was all wrong. I was born sickly, and my birth made my mother very ill. She seemed to get some sort of poisoning when I was born, and for some strange reason it was held against me just as if I had poisoned her. There was nothing I could do about it, I was too young to know anything about it. Anyway, she was very ill, so was I, and I was ill all my life on earth. I was sickly. We had a doctor, Dr. Duncan Stamp. He was one of the real doctors, always studying, always getting different letters after his name. He hadn't much sympathy, but he had plenty of knowledge. He didn't like me and I didn't like him. But I remember one extraordinary thing. One day I was well, they said I was dying. This Dr. Stamp came along to my bed and he seemed to hang something up from a light fixture and run tubes down to me. To this day I don't know what he did, but I made a recovery, and I always thought of him after as the miracle worker. I remember in the Great War, that is the first Great War, my parents and I and my sister were on North Road Station, Plymouth. We had had to visit somebody in an area called Benny Come Quick. It was late at night and suddenly we heard gunfire and searchlight beams flickered across the sky, and in the beam of searchlight I saw my first Zeppelin. It flew over Plymouth and then went out to sea again, but that is another incident I have never forgotten, how that ship looked in the crossed beams of light. Plympton is an old, old place full of history. There is the great church of St. Mary's at the foot of Church Hill. As one went down the hill, the church spire seemed to be still higher than the top of the hill. One went down and went along by the churchyard, and then turned left. If one passed the church, one came to the priory and various old religious houses, the use of which had been discontinued by the clergy because, apparently, some division of power had taken place and the head offices of the church had been removed to Buckfast. Behind the priory there was a pleasant stream in which there were reeds and osiers. Here people used to get reeds and rushes for the making of baskets and other containers. Here, too, 100 or so years before, they used to make mead, which was the drink of the time. The church was a most imposing place, of grey stone, with a great tower with 4 little pillars at each corner of the tower. The bells were wonderful when properly played, and campanologists used to come from all over Devon to ring the changes, as they called them, and the Plympton bell ringers used to go around in their turn showing their own skill. St. Maurice Church was not so grand as that of St. Mary. It was smaller and was obviously a satellite church. In those days St. Maurice and St. Mary's were separate communities with hardly any social movement between them. Colebrook and Underwood had no churches, they had instead to go to St. Maurice or St. Mary. Plympton had its share of great houses, but most of them had been badly damaged by Oliver Cromwell and his men. Many of them had been demolished by the order of Judge Jeffreys, but Plympton Castle, that was a place that fascinated me. There was a great mound with the remnants of sturdy stone walls on it, and the walls were so thick, and some of us found that there was a tunnel going through the walls lengthwise. Some of the more hardy boys said they had been into a strange chamber below the walls in which there were supposed to be skeletons, but I never got to be that venturesome, I just accepted their word. Plympton Castle stood on an amphitheatre, a big round space with a raised bank around it. The raised bank was a very nice place as a promenade, but the sunken piece in between, as if in the centre of a saucer, was much used by circuses and other forms of public entertainment. I was sent to my first school, to a place called, of all unlikely names, Co-op Fields. It was so named because originally it was property owned by the Plympton Cooperative Wholesale Society. The land had been sold to raise funds for other development, and a few houses had been built there, then a few more, and a few more, so that in the end it became a separate community, almost a small village on its own. And here I went to school. It was, well, I think it would be called a dame's school. It was Miss Kings and her sister. Together they ran what purported to be a school, but really it was more to keep unruly children from plaguing their unwilling parents. The walk from Ridgeway right out to Miss King's school was a terrible ordeal for me in my sickly condition, but there was nothing I could do about it, I just had to go. After a time, though, I was considered to be too big to go to that school any longer, so I was transferred to a preparatory school. It was called Mr. Beard's school. Mr. Beard was a nice old man, a really clever old man, but he could not impose discipline. He had retired from school life and then, getting bored with retirement, he had opened his own school, and the only premises he could find was a big room attached to the George Hotel. The George Hotel was at the top of George Hill and was quite well known. One entered under an archway and the ground was paved, and then to get to Mr. Beard's school one had to go all the way through the courtyard, past all the former stables and coach houses. At the far side of the yard there were wooden steps going up to a room which looked as if it had been an assembly hall. That was the first school where I started to learn anything, and I did not learn much, but that was my fault, not the fault of old Beard. Actually, he was far too gentle to be a schoolmaster, people took advantage of him. After a time the Plympton Grammar School reopened in a fresh location. Plympton Grammar School was one of the most famous grammar schools of England. Many famous people had been there, including Joshua Reynolds. In the old grammar school in St. Maurice, his name and the names of many other very famous people were carved into the desks and into the woodwork, but that school building had had to be closed down because the ravages of time had attacked the building and the upper floors were considered to be unsafe. After a long search, a very large house was secured which was in the shadow of Plympton Castle, in the shadow, actually, of that round part where the circuses used to come. Vast sums were paid for its conversion, and I was one of the first pupils to be enrolled in that school. I didn't like it a bit, I hated the place. Some of the teachers had been demobilized from the forces, and instead of treating children as children they treated children as bloody-minded troops. One teacher in particular had a most vicious habit of breaking sticks of chalk in half and throwing each half with all his might at some offender, and although you might think that chalk couldn't do much damage, I have seen a boy's face lacerated by the impact. Nowadays, I suppose the teacher would have gone to prison for bodily assault, but at least it kept us in order. For recreation we had to go to the playing fields of the old grammar school, which gave us a walk of about a mile there. Then all the exercise, etc., a mile back. Eventually time came to leave school. I hadn't done anything to good, but, then, I hadn't done anything to bad either. In addition to schoolwork I had to take some correspondence courses, and I got a few little bits of paper saying I was qualified in this, that, or something else. But when the time came to leave school my parents, without any such frivolities as asking me what I would like to be, apprenticed me to a motor engineering firm in Plymouth. So almost to the day on which I left school I was sent to this firm in Old Town Street, Plymouth. They sold a few cars, etc., but they were more concerned with motorcycles. In fact, they were the South Devon agents for Douglas Motorcycles. Again, it was an unsympathetic place because all that mattered was work. I used to leave Plympton early in the morning and travel by bus to Plymouth, 5.5 miles away. By the time lunchtime came, I was famished, so whatever the weather, I used to take my sandwiches. There was nothing to drink except water, and went to a little park at the back of St. Andrew's Church, Plymouth. There I used to sit in the park and get my sandwiches down as fast as I could, otherwise I should have been late. It was very, very hard work indeed, because sometime we apprentices were sent out as far away as Crown Hill to fetch a heavy motorcycle. Well, we went to Crown Hill or other places by bus, only one of us to one place, of course, and then we were faced with the problem of getting the blasted bikes back. We couldn't ride them because they were faulty, so the only ride we got was going downhill. I remember one time I had to go to Crown Hill to fetch a very big Harley Davidson motorcycle. The owner had telephoned in and said the bike could be picked up right outside, so I went there, got off the bus, saw this motorbike, pushed it off its stand and pushed it away. I had done about 3 miles when a police car pulled up right in front of me. Two policemen got out and I thought they were going to kill me. One grabbed me by the neck, the other grabbed my arms behind me, and also suddenly was propped up by the side of the road, and I was bundled into the back of the police car and whisked off to Crown Hill Police Station. Here a shouting police sergeant threatened me with all manner of terrible deaths unless I told them who were my fellow gangsters. Now, I wasn't very old at this time and I just didn't know what he was talking about, so he gave me a few cuffs about the ears and then put me in a cell. He wouldn't listen to my explanation that I had come to fetch a motorcycle as instructed. About 8 hours later, one of the men from the firm came and identified me, and confirmed that I had been quite legitimately collecting a faulty motorbike. The police sergeant gave me a cuff across the face and told me not to get in trouble again and not to bother them. So I don't like policemen. I have had trouble with police all through my life, and I would swear this. Never have I done anything which warrants police persecution. Each time it has just been police slovenliness, such as that time when they wouldn't let me explain what had happened. The next day, though, the owner of the bike came into the firm and laughed like a maniac. He was quite unsympathetic. He didn't seem to think what a shock it was to be hauled off and taken to a police cell. One day I could hardly get out of bed. I felt ill. I felt so ill I just wanted to die. It was no good. My mother insisted on getting me out of bed. So eventually I had to go without any breakfast. The day was wet and the day was cold. She went with me to the bus stop and shoved me on the old Devon Motor Transport bus so roughly that I fell to my knees. I got to work, but after about 2 hours there I fainted and somebody said I ought to be taken home, but the man in charge said they didn't have time to run around after apprentices in trouble. So I was kept there until the end of the day, no breakfast, no lunch, nothing. At the end of the working day I made my way most dizzily along the street toward the bus stop in front of St. Andrew's Church. Fortunately there was a bus waiting and I collapsed into a corner seat. When I got home I just had enough strength to totter into bed. There wasn't much interest in any welfare. Nobody asked how I was feeling, nobody asked why I couldn't eat my dinner. I just went off to bed. I had a terrible night. I felt I was on fire and I was wet through with perspiration. In the morning my mother came along and awakened me quite roughly, for I had fallen into an exhausted sleep and even she could see that I wasn't well. Eventually she phoned Dr. Stamp. Half a day later he came. He took one look at me and said, "Hospital." So the ambulance came. In those days the ambulance was run by the local undertaker and I was taken off to the South Devon and East Cornwall Hospital. I had very bad lung trouble. I stayed in that hospital for about 11 weeks, and then there was great discussion as to whether I should be sent to a sanatorium or not, because I'd got DB. Father and mother were opposed to it because, they said, they wouldn't have time to come and visit me if I was sent to a sanatorium a few miles away. So I stayed at home and I didn't get much better. Every so often I had to go back to hospital. Then my sight went wrong and I was taken to the Royal Eye Infirmary, Mutley Plain, which wasn't so far from the South Devon and East Cornwall Hospital. This was quite a pleasant hospital, if one can say anything is pleasant when one is blind. But eventually I was released from the hospital with greatly impaired sight and I went home again. By now wireless was well known. It used to be wireless before radio. My father had a crystal set and I thought it was the most marvelous thing I had ever seen in my life. Father studied a lot about radio and he made vast radio sets with many valves to them, and then he set up in business building radio sets for people and doing electrical work for people. At this time it was decided I should go away for a change, and so, as sick as I was put on an old bicycle and sent with a workman to Lidford where I had an aunt. I often wished that this aunt had been my mother. She was a very good woman indeed, and I loved her as I certainly did not love my mother. She looked after me, she really treated me as if I were one of her own children, but, as she said, and it's not much to have a sick child ride 25 miles when he can hardly draw breath. But eventually I had to return home and the journey was much easier this time. Lidford is up in the Devonshire Moors, up in Dartmoor beyond Tavistock, not too far from Okehampton, and the air was pure there and the food good. Back at home in Plymouth I started studying other correspondence courses, and then my mother told me I ought to work. So my father had a lot of radio sets and electrical stuff, so I had to travel about selling the things to small dealers. I went all along Elberton, Modbury, Okehampton, and other places like that selling accumulators, radio parts, and electrical stuff. But after a time the very, very harried life proved to be too much for me and my health broke down. I was driving a car at the time and I went blind. Now, it is a thoroughly unpleasant thing to lose one sight completely and utterly when driving. Fortunately, I was able to stop the car without any damage and I just stayed where I was until somebody came to see what was happening and why I was blocking traffic. For a time I couldn't convince people that I was ill and that I couldn't see, but eventually the police were called and they had me taken by ambulance to hospital. My parents were informed and their first thought was about the car. When the car was driven home, it was found that all the stuff I had had in it was stolen: radio sets, batteries, test equipment, everything. So I was not popular. But a spell in hospital put me right for a time, and then I went home again. I studied some more and eventually it was decided that I should try to get training as a radio operator. So I went to Southampton and outside Southampton there was a special school which trained one to be radio operator aboard aircraft. I stayed there for some time, and passed my examinations and got a license as a first-class wireless operator. I had to go to Croydon to take the examination, and I was successful. At the same time I learned to fly aircraft and managed to get a license at that as well. But I could not pass the medical examination for a commercial license and so I was grounded before my career started. Back at home I was blamed quite a lot for having bad health and for wasting money in taking these courses when my health was so poor that I had been rejected. I felt a bit irritated by that because I was not to blame for my bad health, I didn't want to be ill. But there was a big family conference and my parents decided something would have to be done. I was just wasting my life. At that identical moment the local sanitary inspector, who was very friendly with my parents, said there was a great opening for smoke inspectors, particularly in the big cities. People were getting worried about the ecology and there was too much smoke pollution from factories and industrial concerns, so a new category of smoke inspectors had been started. There were, of course, sanitary inspectors and sanitary inspectors who were meat inspectors. But now there was a new category: smoke inspectors. The chief sanitary inspector said it would be just the thing for me. It was a good job, well paid, and I would have to take a special course, naturally. So a new correspondence course had just been brought out for smoke inspectors. I studied it at home and passed very quickly, in 3 months actually. And then I was told I would have to go to London to study with the Royal Sanitary Institute in Buckingham Palace Road. So not too happily my parents advanced the money and I went to London. Every day I attended classes at the Royal Sanitary Institute, and often we went out on field trips going to factories, power stations, and all manner of queer places. At last, after 3 months, we had to go to an immense examination hall where there seemed to be thousands of people milling around. We were all in little groups. One who was going to take a particular examination would be isolated from others taking the same type of examination. Anyway, I passed the examination and got a certificate as a smoke inspector.